we have a brand new doctor on Piled High and Deep, the podcast today. 7 years of labor has resulted in a doctorate in English literature for Christopher Haynes, PhD. His journey started out typically enough. A love of Lord of the Rings turns a young man's fancy to medieval literature. Well, that served him well for the undergrad and his master's, and it even carried him through the comprehensive exams for his PhD. He even started on the dissertation. Then the reality struck.
It got to a point where I realized that I was trying to shoehorn a curiosity that I had in 2008 into a legitimate, viable, you know, field intervening project in 2014, at the point where I had this realization, and it just wasn't working. It hadn't worked over that great number of years, and it wasn't going to work in the current environment that I was in, you know, my situation in the program.
So Chris did what any bright young man in his position would do. He turned to comic books. That's right. He moved from medieval literature to comic books, and he used his experiences with both to help shape his dissertation. He's also using comic books and graphic novels in the classroom, along with social media, to explore alternative ways for students to learn and experience literature and pop culture. So join me as we pile it high and deep with a journey that starts off with a dream of being a musician and turns to Tolkien, The Watchmen, and a shiny new PhD. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conti. Check out my blog at themountaingeek.net. I'm on Twitter at themountaingeek. And the podcast also has a Twitter account at PhD Podcast, Facebook account, Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Well, enough of the social media nonsense. Let's start shoveling.
Chris Haynes, first of all, I have to ask, were your shoulders, have they started coming up since Friday? Congratulations on the PhD.
Well, thank you. It's been a strange weekend of burden lifting. I think I haven't yet realized that it's over.
Well, I can't imagine. So, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, I don't want to, I have a wife, I have two kids. Mm-hmm. You know, that was only 9 months that she gestated those children. I'm taking a look at your dissertation. You did your undergrad in 2000. You finished your undergrad in 2004 or 6?
5, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, I got right in between.
Yeah, mid-year, December 2005.
You did. When did you finish your master's?
2009.
Okay.
So here I started this program in 2010, fall of 2010. Okay. This is my 7th year in the PhD.
Well, what took you so long? Come on, man.
That's a question I ask myself often.
At what point did you realize you had it?
The dissertation?
We'll get to that dissertation, but I want to jump ahead, and then we're going to jump back, and it's going to be back and forth here.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's 300 pages of dissertation there.
Yeah.
At what point did you realize, I'm going to get this done?
That's a good question.
Because, I mean, 8 years, that's not easy. Mm. You're probably thinking, there's no way. Money, whatever, emotional energy, physical energy, the whole ability to get it done. Mm-hmm. But at what point did you finally realize that, yeah, I think I've got something here and I'm going to be successful and it's going to get done?
So to be totally honest, it wasn't really until summer 2016, I mean, just this last summer, right, where I really felt that I had a handle on what I was trying to say, why what I was trying to say was useful, and who might actually want to hear it. So almost everything up to that point was, you know, fits and starts and draft work and lots of words that didn't end up getting used, and the building process of getting myself to a point where I felt confident speaking to a defined field. So it was all that latent energy, multiple years of latent energy building up. And in my case, it was kind of 2 or 3 different projects as we went along. And then just in the home stretch, I felt like my writing caught up to my thinking and I was able to actually express what I wanted to express.
Now, this is only my 8th episode. I can't remember. I know it's already early. That's why I lose count swimming laps. And I've talked to scientists that have clearly defined scientific pathways that they're going. I've talked to you would now be my third thinking, thoughtful. I mean, not that anybody.
I don't think the scientists would like that.
No. And I don't mean that. But but this is what we're talking with the path that you went down. It's not the hard numbers and facts. Mm-hmm. It's you have ideas that you're supporting with others that have written before you, and you're digesting and brewing up your ideas based on what they've written and what you're experiencing throughout this process. Is that what you expected? And if it was, what made you think this is what you wanted to do?
That's a difficult question.
I mean, did you always, how long have you wanted to be a PhD?
So for me, I have variously wanted and not wanted to be a PhD at different times. For me, my pattern was in any degree program I was in at the start, I was super amped, wanted to pursue a life and a career in the academy. And then by the end of the program, I was usually so jaded that I decided that I wanted to burn everything down and leave. And this PhD was the first time where I really felt that I wasn't responding to a perception about the academy. I wasn't sort of burdened by my naive and, you know, sometimes unrealistic expectations about the academy. I felt toward the end here that I actually had a book length worth of things, a book's length of stuff to say, to talk about, to work through an idea. And that idea was valuable and earned me a position in an intellectual field. And I think that's the unique thing about a PhD. And in some ways, it's a unique thing about a humanities PhD, which is that it is a conversation that you're entering, and it involves proving a lot of points, right? And dealing with a tremendous amount of evidence and synthesizing meaning through that bank of evidence. But it's about furthering a conversation that's been happening for a lot longer than you've been participating in it. And so it's a different form of data analysis. It's a different form of engagement with the critical field. And I think for me, it was really the latter couple years of this program where I really felt the confidence in participating in that conversation.
Is that because when you got to that point, you were the youngest guy in the room?
Well, I personally felt a little bit of that kind of energy. I felt a little bit like some of what I was responding to was senior folks in higher education perceiving things a particular way, and in some instances being unable to see outside of their own historical perspective. And so there is kind of an outsider energy being someone, you know, working through a PhD in the humanities, where you feel like you are, you know, everyone talks about the intervention you have to make in the field, right? That's the thing. And sometimes that intervention is very logical, very methodical. You know, you sort of build incrementally on an existing body of knowledge. And sometimes that intervention can feel more personally righteous, you know, like you're correcting a wrong, you know, that has existed. And whether or not either of those things are actually true, that's how you feel it when you're going through the process. And so I think there is value in that insurgent kind of energy.
How many laptops did you go through?
Shockingly, the laptop I started this program with is the one I'm finishing.
Wow,
with.
Yeah, that's impressive.
It's a shock, and it's a Mac, so I can't believe it lasted this long with no hard drive crashes and nothing. But yeah, I mean, the number of draft files and file history in my cloud services is astonishing, you know.
All right, let's start at the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up in just outside Rochester, New York.
Okay.
Spencerport was the town. My father is an academic. He's an environmental science professor, has been at SUNY Brockport for quite some time. So I saw the academic life, at least from the scientist's perspective, from early on. And for me, it was sort of a foregone conclusion that I would be in some educational capacity because almost everyone in my family is an educator in some way, not necessarily higher education and not necessarily formal education, but an educator in some way.
Mom?
Same. Master's in education, taught reading to elementary school kids for, you know, most of her working time.
So you grew up more books than TV and video games.
Yeah. I mean, I played my Super Nintendo and you know, that was a huge part of my life for a while. But yeah, it was a house full of books and there's so much value in being around that environment.
Right.
Yeah.
What were you most successful in academic-wise, school-wise, in that, middle school, early high school? Where did you find your strengths? Yeah. Was it in the humanities or was it in the sciences because of your dad?
So for me, it was almost always in, you know, the language arts, broadly defined. I mean, I successfully moved through middle school and high school science and math, but not as successfully. You know, I mean, it wasn't stellar in that area. In my family, I took after my mother more so in that way. My sister got the sort of science genes, if we want to say it that way. So I worked hard, you know, and I succeeded in the classes that I was in. But really, for me, the enduring interest was in language, and for a long time, it was in music too. I mean, I started my higher education career in a music program, and then hopped over to English when I started to feel, maybe stifled by the conservatory kind of environment.
What instrument?
Electric bass.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jaco, Getty guy.
I actually auditioned with some chunks of Jaco.
Okay.
Yeah.
What role did math and science play then for you in, was there a challenge at home in, dad's pressuring, so your dad's not going to be, come out and throw the baseball, but, let's work on some equations. Let's go dip a cup full of goo from the pond and look at it under the microscope kind of thing. Were you pushing back on that?
Well, so there were certainly some elements of the looking at goo versus playing catch, kind of model in my relationship with my father. And I think, the expectation of both of my parents was that my siblings and I would work hard and would accomplish to the best of our ability what we could academically and socially.
College was expected, though.
I think college was expected. I think it wasn't ever spoken as such, but I think it would have been surprising had either my sister or I consciously chosen not to go to college. I think my family would have accommodated that choice, but it was kind of like it was an unspoken expectation. And I mean, to that end, graduate school was sort of an unspoken expectation too, as both my sister and I worked through our undergraduate work.
The noise you hear in the background, somebody's wrong. We're in some old haunts of mine here at Hellum's Arts and Sciences building on the campus of the University of Colorado. I spent a lot of time here. So you certainly did, Chris.
Yeah. Yeah.
So apologies for the noise. Your sister did grad school also? Mm-hmm. Is she a teacher?
She is, but actually not for what she initially went to post-secondary school for. So, yeah, she teaches middle school science at an international school in Morocco.
Oh.
Her path took her from undergraduate to some law school to Peace Corps, actually, and then through to a master's in education and then teaching internationally.
That's
so,
cool.
Yeah, she got the teaching bug, too. And she loves it.
Is that a nature or a nurture thing, you think, for your family?
I think that's a hard question. It's hard to
Were your grandparents educators?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, so
this is a multi-generational thing. I mean, it's hard to ignore the nature component of it. But certainly there was a nurture component as well. I mean, I've always felt that, you know, to educate takes a particular knowledge base, obviously, but it takes a particular emotional and compassionate knowledge and engagement as well. And I feel that you can be the most brilliant person in any room you're in and be a terrible teacher, right? To teach takes an extra particular set of skills, social emotional skills. And even with the high concentration of, you know, very highly educated, you know, brilliant people in my family and scientists for that matter, everyone still manages to be a very effective educator. And so while I didn't always know that that's what I wanted to do, it was kind of always lurking in the back of my mind.
How did you choose your undergrad location? Duquesne, right?
Duquesne University, yeah, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That was when I was still auditioning, you know, for music schools. And so I was looking for regional, you know, kind of northeast to Rust Belt regional schools that had strong music programs with academic tracks in recording technology. Because at the time, you know, hot on the heels of my high school band. I wanted to be a studio engineer, you know, and producer, that sort of thing. And so I was trying to find schools that balanced traditional music education in the conservatory model with the sort of, you know, cutting edge tech, and Duquesne had that.
Yeah, because I was going to say Rochester has, what's the music school at the University of Rochester?
Oh, yeah, Eastman School.
Yeah.
If I was going for a kind of traditional conservatory model, it would have been natural to choose Eastman. Yeah, and Eastman's great. You get so much great music in Rochester comes from Eastman students.
Dear friend of mine, Viola, from Rochester.
There you go.
So at what point what was the turning point? Was it the pure idea that they weren't treating music as maybe as freely as you were looking to have it?
The answer to the question here is going to sound so pretentious. And I apologize in advance for that. But it was second semester, freshman year, one of the sort of semester-long assignments was composing a sonata. And I thought about that assignment, and I thought about the sort of improvisational music that I was, you know, working on and performing in the bands that I was in, and the sort of, you know, rock and roll energy that I was bringing from my high school band experiences. And I was like, this is not how I want to engage music in my life. You know, it all of a sudden became the academic engagement with music was pulling me away from how I wanted to be a musician, which sounds totally lame now. It's like, I would love to write a sonata today. You know, that'd be great. Well, great time doing that.
There are certainly decisions that we make when we're younger that you go back and you go, really?
Yeah.
But it does kind of make a lot of sense. We mentioned Jaco before. Mm-hmm. If you talk about the great jazz or even rock bassists, mm-hmm. They are improvisers. Mm-hmm. Or they're not, you know, they're finding a groove that's not necessarily going to be down that conservatory or that academic bent. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. What then moved you away from even that idea of going down that engineering route? Because the music production, you said that's why you chose Duquesne, because they had kind of that parallel path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the aspect that I missed. The sort of professional training that I would have gotten in record engineering was something that I miss even now. You know, I mean, I got, you know, amateur experience with that, and, you know, playing with people and performing with people and recording with people after the fact. But that was it kind of had to be part and parcel, because the way that Duquesne's the way that the music program was set up, you know, required both components to kind of operate at once, and which was initially why I chose it, and that was why, you know, it was kind of a difficult decision, I guess, to leave that.
But there must have been something in Duquesne that you found in making that transfer then to English, because mm-hmm. you stayed there through your master's.
I did, yeah. Actually, I got lucky. Well, I guess I don't know if lucky is the right way to say it, but I hopped over to English because that was always, if I didn't pursue music, you know, literature was what I knew I wanted to pursue. And, you know, that was the constant refrain of my parents in the college process, college application process was, you know, think about, you know, liberal arts colleges, that sort of thing, to get that well-rounded education. And so I knew that there was a core interest in studying literature, and I really just fell into what I found out to be a very close-knit, academically rigorous, you know, socially engaging English department with great faculty and great colleagues, you know, in terms of the students. It felt like all of the sudden I was in the kind of literary study environment that I would have wanted to be in. And I just kind of fell into it, like, by default, because I was at Duquesne. It was mid-semester. I had to fall into something. And then I liked the courses enough that second semester, freshman year, that I stayed.
So when we talk about English degrees, Steve Lamos, who was previous guest on the PhD here at CU, also has, do you know Steve over mm-hmm. at the writing department?
Yeah.
So you know about his musical background.
Also a great musician. Yeah,
great musician. Yeah. So his English background tends to be more on the composition side and the structure of the English language.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the after the word is written side of it.
Yes.
Okay.
You could say it that way.
What was your focus? Was there any? Tell me about an English lit degree.
Well, the English lit degree is a complex beast, and one of the great benefits of it is that it is a vehicle for a huge variety of different personal expressions and scholarly expressions. I mean, that's a real asset in that you do not know what to expect of an English degree. You make the English degree yourself. For me, and I now am unashamed to admit this, I wanted to be J.R.R. Tolkien. Like that was it. I mean, I was obsessed with Lord of the Rings and the fantasy tradition that sort of came out of that. And to me, Tolkien represented a kind of archetypal English professor that was very attractive to me.
Dude wrote two languages.
Well, I mean, and spoke like, or could read, you know, 33 or something.
Right.
Made up his. I mean, you know, I mean, so yeah, language, and the history of language was the core for me, and then literature became, you know, the expression of those things, the play of that history, and so that's what really drew me to books, and the academic study of language, a la, you know, that sort of nostalgic rose-colored vision of Tolkien was incredibly alluring as a college undergraduate. I went in, you know, my focus was medieval, specifically Middle English literature, and then some Old English literature as well, and I carried that through, you know, through the master's and even into this program here, and it wasn't until pretty late in the game that I sort of hopped off of that train and decided to pursue a different project.
We can go down the Tolkien road maybe later in some other podcast that you and I decide maybe to do together some of the time. But
indeed.
But let's just admit right now, Tolkien, amazing storyteller, horrible writer.
You know, I'm going to push back on that. So there okay, are maybe elements.
Maybe not horrible. Horrible might elements. Be a harsh word for it. Not the best writer. How about that?
Well, I guess it depends on what qualifies as best, right? So Tolkien excelled at slow description. And if slow description is your jam, then you're going to love Tolkien.
You're right.
Right? Yes. So but for a great number of people that read Tolkien, that is not their jam.
No.
And so it's really plodding.
It
and
is.
It feels very sort of
but labored. But what's interesting is The Hobbit, oh man, we're really getting off the topic here real quick.
Wasn't this supposed to be another podcast?
Yeah, it was, yeah. But The Hobbit isn't, the Hobbit certainly reads very quickly, to me at least, without mm-hmm. that, without the broad exposition that you get mm-hmm. from the three other books
yeah.
that love them, you know.
Yeah.
Next to the sci-fi Bach guys, you know, it's Tolkien is next. And by Bach, we're talking about Bradbury, Asimov, Clarke, and Heinlein. Mm-hmm. But that's for a different day completely. let's move on.
Yeah.
So this idea of looking into medieval literature, going back to Chaucer. I'm guessing there's some others in there as well. Mm-hmm. That takes you into your PhD. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just going to... The PhD title is amazing.
Now, Thank you.
Number one, I love I love dissertation titles. They're just awesome.
It could be a genre all itself.
You know, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I got to give a shout out to Andy Schneidkraut up at Albums on the Hill. He hooked me. He put Chris and I together, as well as Steve Lamos, previous episode. But when I told Andy that I was doing this podcast, he goes, "You got to talk to Chris. He's doing his dissertation. I don't understand it, but it's on comic books." So it's comic books. How great is that? And admittedly, I'm not the biggest comic book guy. I didn't really grow up with them. I haven't, you know, I'm somewhat touching graphic novels on occasion. Mm-hmm. I certainly appreciate them for the storytelling that's provided in them. Mm-hmm. As a wannabe writer myself, I see that I maybe have some stories in me that could translate well to a graphic novel. All right, so anyway, here we go. Here's the dissertation title, folks. Convergence and Contest, Humanism, Comic Books, and Higher Education in the Digital Age. We talked about humanism before. We're touching on the comic books. And I think that there's still this idea of people not understanding the true literary value of comic books. There's still a segment of people, not saying everybody, but there's still people that think of them as being those dime store picture books that are on the whirligig at the soda fountain. We don't have soda fountains anymore.
The metaphorical soda fountain.
Yeah. So when you think about comic books, well, let me back up then. Have comic books always been important to you?
Not always. So I wasn't one of those kids who grew up with comics and, you know, spent every penny of your allowance, you know, on a right. new comic. That wasn't really me. I had a few things here and there. I had some X-Men comics, some Silver Surfer comics, you know, just like a handful of things. But I wasn't, you know, invested in the continuity, and I wasn't, you know, going every week.
Vinyl ate up my pocket money. I don't know about for you.
Well, CDs for me.
Well, yeah. You're a little younger than I am.
But comic books, I came to comic books sort of in earnest, I guess, in around 2007, 2008, that kind of era. Just as a reader, not in terms of academic study. I was just curious, and you know, I mean, it's so stereotypical, but Watchmen was like the first real thing that I sort of bought without being interested in a kind of superhero universe already. That, you know, it has an immense reputation, and I was curious, and I read it, loved it, and I begrudgingly admit that I love Alan Moore. Even though that's, you know, for some people, a mark of death. But it that was sort of the start of my deeper dive into, you know, what people call graphic novels. Right. And now I kind of have zoomed back out into larger comic book, you know, major market comic book continuities, that sort of thing. And, you know, weird indie producers, that sort of thing, too.
Neil Gaiman, Sandman. Claudio Sanchez and Coheed and Cambria, you know that one?
So, you know what, I know Coheed and Cambria was one of my favorite bands for a long time.
Just saw them two weeks ago. They were amazing. And for my fifth time.
That was, I ran off topic again. Of course, right. But yeah, I saw Coheed and Cambria open for the Juliana Theory in a club in Buffalo.
Well, that was a long time ago.
I'd never heard of them before. It was one of those like magical live show experiences where you hear something that you've never heard before and you're like, I absolutely love this. I'm engrossed. I didn't even care about the Juliana Theory at that point afterwards. But yeah, that's a really great illustration of how comic books can infuse and inform other forms of media.
So if you don't know Coheed and Cambria, tremendous progressive metal band. The lead singer, Claudio Sanchez, also writes this comic book series, graphic novel series, called called The Amory Wars, and it's the story of two brothers, Coheed and Cambria. Just amazing. I know the overarching story because the comics have been hard to get since I I only found Coheed about 5 years ago, so they've been very hard to get. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, they've re-released them. Mm-hmm. They're starting to come to my house. I hope my wife isn't listening to this because, yeah. No, honey, that's not the new Playboy. Those are comic books that your soon-to-be 50-year-old husband is now buying.
All right, that's still an improvement, though.
All right, so we've already discussed the fact that it took you 8 years from the time you first stepped onto campus here at the University of Colorado Boulder until you walked at Folsom Field on Friday. When, let's get into this dissertation, because, mm-hmm. come on, man, it can't take you 8 years to come up with a dissertation about comic books and humanism.
So, practically, it didn't take me that long to come up with a dissertation on humanism and comic books. My time in this program has been sort of bifurcated. So I started pursuing a dissertation project on some relatively esoteric medieval religious texts. That was an extension of some of the research that I'd done in my master's program, and I was deepening it here. And I got...
You just wanted to go to England.
Well, I Come did. I did. And I got the chance to. My study abroad was at Oxford, which fulfilled that sort right. of Tolkien romantic narrative that we referred to earlier. But, you know, I got all the way through the comprehensive exam stage on that project, that medieval literature project, and through the prospectus, dissertation prospectus stage with that project. And it got to a point where I realized that I was... trying to shoehorn a curiosity that I had in 2008 into a legitimate, viable, you know, field intervening project in 2014, at the point where I had this realization, and it just wasn't working. It hadn't worked over that great number of years, and it wasn't going to work in the current environment that I was in, you know, my situation in the program. So it was 2014 where I decided to sort of figure out if I could revamp and start over with a new project. Now there's, you know, conceptual overlap between the two. What I learned in studying very hard on that esoteric medieval religious, you know, vernacular text helped me understand the ideas that eventually were expressed through this dissertation. But it was really from 2014 to now that this project took shape.
Where did the basis for the idea that you came up with for your dissertation? How does that flow from taking a look at medieval religious texts?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, the way I've been thinking about it, and it's a question that I ask myself often as I was writing this dissertation, is that I was interested in two things. I was interested in the intersection between vernacular linguistic expression, so the language of the people, right? A non-academic, non-scholarly language. The intersection between that and traditional, highly valuable scholarly languages. So in the medieval period, you know, if you're looking at Middle English, that's the difference between Middle English and Latin, right?
Right.
So the intersection between those languages and how literary expression can operate in both modes and what it means for literary expression to operate in both modes. So that question of how vernacular language encounters authority was one that I was very curious about and carried over. And the other question that, and this is actually what comic books taught me, was a question of how art produced, you know, by people, right, in culture, how art accumulates cultural capital, right? Like how it becomes recognized or prestigious or valuable or otherwise acknowledged on a broad scale, how art gains that cultural capital and also sheds it and how those dynamics work together. So the two ideas dovetailed one another, right? Because when you're looking at a vernacular literary environment that's kind of in engagement with an established academic literary environment or one that's more prestigious, the ways that those literary expressions sort of move through culture will vary in their, you know, how much capital they carry, right? So comic books taught me that something, despite something being incredibly low on the scale of cultural capital, right? Like the common understanding is that comics are just, you know, frivolous things, whatever. I mean, that was the criticism, right? They were for kids. And yet now we're in a moment where comics aren't for kids anymore all of a sudden, and comics carry a tremendous amount of cultural capital and financial capital when you consider, you know, how popular movies and television based on comics are. You know, comics are an example of how vernacular art travels through very interesting pathways through academic culture, because academic culture is what brands things with a certain level of prestige. And to see comics kind of buttressing that, sort of figuring out how to navigate that academic world, was very curious to me. So that really looking at how vernacular art worms its way through culture was the basis for the dissertation. And so what ended up happening was I realized that higher education is a good case study for looking at that phenomenon, because higher education, on the one hand, carries a tremendous amount of historical baggage when it comes to, you know, validating something and determining what has value and what doesn't.
Right.
And then also higher education now finds itself needing to experiment and find different ways and different pathways through both the production of knowledge and the, you know, transference of that knowledge in the form of education.
So, and that's been some of your work also in these 8 years that you've been here at CU, is, and in looking at your CV, you've been spending some time thinking about what are those other ways that people can get that knowledge stuffed into their brains, right?
Mm-hmm.
And from there, do you specifically take a look at that in terms of the use of not just comic books, but other media in the popular culture?
Yeah, the use of comic books was sort of the doorway into the larger questions about the stakes of higher education itself in the digital age. So, you know, comic studies is the, you know, the academic field around comic books and graphic novels. And it's, for being fairly small, it's pretty robust and very self-aware as an academic field. It's sort of continually asking itself why it exists, right? Whereas most academic fields just know that they exist,
right,
and they go on plodding forward and doing the things that they do.
Is that because of the age? Or is that because there's, you know, the relative age of the study compared to everything else that's out there? Or is that, or is there still this sense of, we're just not, yeah, we know, but we're just not quite, fully self, what's the word? We're comfortable enough in our own skin to be, to know that what we're doing and to stand up to the rest of the rest of the bully, not bullies in the room, but the big boys.
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think certainly a new field, any new academic field, finds itself going through a phase of self-definition. And also, I think comic studies carries with it, and I think this is an asset, it carries with it some of the marginalization of its subject, right? So, like, it feels a little bit like it has a burden of proof, right? That it has to work with and overcome. And I think that can be really good for a field, because it can really force people to think outside the box and figure out how to express what it is they're doing in their scholarship in a different sort of way. It can also lead to sort of ad nauseum, redefinitions of the field itself and trying to find some perfect language to define what a comic book is or what comic studies is, that sort of thing. So I think the field is still kind of emerging in its own skin. But I found the field to be so incredibly refreshing coming from medieval studies, which frankly is one of the oldest, humanities academic fields, and has some.
And really, can there really be anything else new about medieval studies? And while I say that half jokingly, at some point, haven't we just beaten the horse enough?
Well, that's the beauty about literary study, is that it's responsive to its cultural environment. So it's not like a a pool full of water that you're draining water out of, and when you have no more water left, there's nothing else left to say about Chaucer, right? Like Chaucer continually interfaces culture.
We cannot talk about Chaucer anymore.
Just... we could have a whole episode on Chaucer. So you know, the good thing about academic study is as I said, it responds to its cultural environment, and since our cultural environment is always changing, that response is always changing, and so. Even an old field like medieval studies has a tremendous amount of young, innovative energy, but the innovative energy that is producing scholarship in the field is not quite the same thing as the institutional location of the field within higher education. Those relationships are much more codified than the sort of exciting, you know, articles and books that people are writing. And comic studies has yet to be codified as an institutional field. You know, comic scholars show up in communications departments and media studies departments and art history departments and English departments and anywhere else. And so that having that kind of institutional freedom makes the field pretty exciting. And so I was attracted to that flexibility and responsiveness. And comics became a teaching tool for my dissertation. You know, the study of comics taught me how to reevaluate the dynamics of capital, both cultural and financial, and also the relationships between, you know, art and readers and time as they move together. I sort of learned from comics how to talk about these ideas.
During this process, did you get a chance to talk to any comic book writers or authors? Mm-hmm. Or was that not necessarily what you were looking for in this process?
Yeah, so I did not in any sort of formal capacity, but partly that was because I wasn't, the emphasis on comics in my dissertation was not on a particular creator or a particular work. So it that sort of more intensive, immersive look into a single creator didn't really make sense for the project. There are a couple creators who were very instructive to me, and I would love to sit down and talk with them about what they were doing. And I did actually have some communication with Chris Ware, who's a, you know, pretty well-known indie comics writer and creator now, sort of on a tangential aspect of that given chapter that didn't end up making it into the dissertation. So that was kind of fun to, you know, talk with someone who you really respect.
Well, absolutely. So let's talk about the humanism then aspect of what it is that you're taking a look at. What's the humanism element to that? Mm-hmm. And first of all, define humanism for me in your and I know it's a big broad it's a moving target, it seems.
Yeah.
But in the context of what you've written here, how do you view it?
Yeah, that's a great question. If you were sitting in the room during my dissertation defense, you would realize that was one of the ideas that needed to be pressed on a little harder in the dissertation. But so humanism for me, and really in some ways the more specific category of humanist education, was a category of thought, a sort of conceptual range that allowed me to access the relationship between art objects, right? So printed books or comic books and their readers as each of those two things moves through time, right? So humanism, the touchstone for me for humanism was the sort of Italian Renaissance humanist scholars who looked back to Greco-Roman literature and culture as a sort of golden age that they wanted to excavate and sort of cause to reemerge in their own day, right? So the rebirth of the Renaissance was the injection of Greco-Roman literature and culture into a sort of post-medieval Europe. Now, of course, that's kind of a convenient historical narrative that's not really as true as is the truth that, you know, people knew about Greek and Roman writers for the whole time, and, you know, manuscript, you know, transmission was occurring and that sort of thing. So that's kind of a simple narrative, but that's how the humanists of that era framed their work, was a sort of a look to the past in order to revise or reform or renovate the present to build a better future. So humanism for me and for the dissertation is really about time. And the add-on to that is that in the process of looking backward to a classical literature and then creating a vernacular literature in the present from those, from that scaffold, and then projecting that into the future, that process requires a kind of manipulation of cultural and symbolic capital on the part of the humanist, right? So to value the a particular object from the past so highly that it warrants that work and the sort of transmission of it in the present, you know, makes a particular, it causes those choices to be weighted with symbolism, right? So like which texts do they choose to keep, and which right. texts get translated and reprinted in new languages, that sort of thing. So for me, the early modern and late medieval humanists demonstrated a particular kind of literary work that caused time and value to be jumbled up together.
So that's where, don't lose track of that.
Yeah.
But that's where you're bringing in your medieval stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So on that front, the printed book, the sort of early printed book, and specifically the work of William Caxton, who was England's first major printer, that the early printed book and the comic book in the purview of this dissertation are sort of parallel art objects.
Okay.
Right. So they both operate on a premise of a sort of condensing of time and contesting of value, right? That's where the title came from, right. Convergence and contest. So what I learned about in the early stages of my graduate education, what I learned about medieval book production, about medieval literature, about the intersection between vernacular and, you know, authorized language, all of those ideas informed what I was discovering about comic books later on. And so the perhaps professionally risky but intellectually more rewarding aspect of this dissertation was bridging those time spans, right? Was looking at Dante and then early printed books and then comic books in the early 20th century and then, you know, online courses of the last few years. You know, most humanities dissertations, especially most literature dissertations, max out at about 100-year time span. Like that's what your advisor recommends you right. to do. That's what's expected in terms of the production of an academic monograph.
Instead, you've gone five.
I went a little beyond that that scope. And so for me, this dissertation was following a thread of curiosity through to its completion. And there were some sacrifices that went along with that. And ease of legibility was one of those things, right? Like it's a harder thing to buy in to the idea that somehow William Caxton's printed books can teach us about modern higher education. It's a harder thing to buy into that than it is to say, you know, some particular acute thing about William Caxton's early printed books or something like that.
How hard was this idea to sell to your committee and your advisors?
Well, I got lucky in that I had a very sympathetic advisor.
Who was probably just tired of seeing your mug? Oh, sorry, yes. Did I say that
it's
out loud?
Done. It's just get him out of here. I had a very sympathetic advisor and an advisor who was willing to take the leap as long as things stayed grounded in a real sense of the historical evidence. Right?
Okay.
So in the moments where I started to get a little too fanciful about these trans-historical connections, you know, those were moments where he was like, you know, let's bring it back to like the actual text. So he bought into the idea early, which was lucky for me because then he signed on to be my advisor in this kind of mid program switch, and then stayed with me through the process in a way that was very perhaps unconventional and very valuable to me, in that it helped me with thinking that the idea was worth pursuing. You know, in any PhD program, a PhD candidate perhaps spends way too much time thinking about what their advisor thinks about them, when most advisors are not thinking about the graduate student unless the graduate student is actually in the room at that given moment. And so, you know, that's the burden that graduate students bear. But for me, I was lucky in that I had an advisor who was supportive of this sort of non-traditional project and helped me in really critical ways when things could have kind of gone off the rails.
Where does this lead now for you?
Yeah. That's the operative question, isn't it? Right? What value
does that's what the wife wants to know. She sent me an email. She said, will you ask him what he's planning on doing with the rest of his life now?
Well, she's been very helpful too, so I'm lucky in that way as well. So for me, I foresee a couple of different career paths. So on the one hand, I think there is still marketable value in this project on the, you know, in the sort of traditional academic tracks. So I think, you know, I think there's an option to still think about the faculty life. Although in English, the faculty life is pretty hard to achieve these days. The market is incredibly competitive, and you have to be very honest with yourself on whether you're legitimately a, you know, a competitive candidate in those kind of fields. Where I think I see greater opportunity is in, well, so this is a sort of catch-all. People call it the alt-ac market, or alternative academic jobs, which are non, you know, exclusively teaching or research jobs still at colleges and universities. I think there's a lot of potential in getting people with, you know, PhD level credentials into the process of curriculum and program design, especially as those things are emerging in digital education, right? Because on-campus education is pretty well established. Most programs and departments are pretty well established. The field of online education is still kind of wide open in a lot of ways, and still has a tremendous amount of convincing to do, even though it shouldn't have to.
Let's dig into that real quick.
Yeah.
Because I am... Listen, 5.5 of the best years of my life were spent on this campus. Very much of who I am today is because of what I experienced here in school. And while I wasn't the best student, but I also wasn't the biggest drinker or the biggest partier, I see a tremendous amount of great positivity in my life because I came to school, I came to class, I interacted with other human beings, I had to live in a dorm, I had to live off campus, I had to get all these things and develop life skills within that. But I think on the other side of that is when I sat in small rooms like we're in today, having group discussions, or when I was in my senior level reading class or whatever it was, where you're reading something and you have to give a presentation about that, or there is a specific discussion about a topic, and you learn to listen to people and form your ideas on the fly. To me, if we're going down a digital education pathway, or in these MOOCs, which is
massive open online course.
Okay.
Yep.
I always forget what the other O is.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that opportunity is being missed, and as a result, what are the consequences of that? I work in the insurance industry. I work with a lot of lawyers. It's not a bad thing. But people go to law school to learn a certain way to think. Different law schools have different ways of doing that. But for the most part, people go to law school to learn a specific way to think, and then hopefully they make money. So I'm wondering if we're losing out on an opportunity to make sure that we continue to have interpersonal dialogue with other human beings as a result of putting a focus on digital education.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a big topic and a big question that you lay out. So there's a couple ways that I respond to it. The first is that the 5.5 year experience that you describe, right? Or, you know, for the sort of traditional undergraduate, the 4 year experience.
Oh, sure. Throw that in my face.
Residential on a campus.
But hey, to my children who are listening, yes, daddy's only paying for 4 years. Get it done.
Yeah. No super seniors.
No super seniors. No.
So that experience, the 4 year residential experience, you know, 18 to 22, is no longer It never really was, but it's certainly no longer even close to a universal description of how most undergraduates in the United States experience higher education. So many undergraduates out of the 21 or 22 million undergraduates at any given time, many undergraduates have that experience, although it is a lower percentage than I think most people might expect. And certainly that experience, as it is depicted in movies on, like, you know, beautiful quads with, you know, falling, you know, colored leaves and stuff, you know, at the sort of like small college experience, that's an even smaller fraction right. of the experience of most undergraduates. So what all those other people are doing is taking classes, raising their kids, working their full-time jobs or part-time jobs, or, you know, staying with their ailing parents who had a health emergency, right? I mean, the contingencies are endless. And so what the residential experience, while very romantic, does not accomplish is accommodating a wide variety of life experiences and backgrounds, right? So, and on top of all of that, the four-year residential experience is a privileged experience, right?
Oh, no doubt about it.
It just does not serve the broad spectrum of people and backgrounds that require or desire undergraduate education. So,
but it was a lot of fun.
Indeed. And it's a lot of fun for a lot of people. And it has enduring value for all the reasons that you described.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I mean, you know, the big hype in 2012, which was the year of the MOOC, right? The big hype was that all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this new platform technology would render irrelevant and non-existent the four-year residential experience. And it's 2017. That certainly has not happened. We know that that was never the intention of MOOCs, nor will it really be their legacy. But even beyond that, MOOCs are one very new and fairly reasonably untested technology for digital education. Other forms of digital education or distance education have existed, you know, for a century and a half, and it hasn't destroyed the residential experience for those people who can afford it and who want to access it. So I think the argument about what will or how will digital education destroy residential education is one that doesn't really look at the landscape of higher education as it exists now. It looks at one tiny sliver compared to another tiny sliver, and those two tiny slivers are kind of diametrically, you know, or polar opposites right. of one another. There's a whole lot of middle ground in there where students are being educated in a variety of different ways. And in fact, the way that most students encounter digital education is by taking a class here or there online or in hybrid form while they're residential students on a college campus, you know, or at a community college doing face-to-face classes as well. So the rhetoric around online education, digital education is very polarizing, but the truth of how people actually are educated in that way, it's just, I mean, it's day to day. It's business on campus. That's what campuses do.
But
so,
and at the end of the day,
yeah,
when I take a look at my daughter who just finished her freshman year up at UNC, mm-hmm. That 1 year costs more than my entire 5.5 years at CU almost.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have to have a significant conversation about
yeah.
how are we, if we're going to continue to produce college-educated people that have well-rounded mm-hmm. degrees and education and can speak well and can mm-hmm. write well and can form thoughts that mm-hmm. allow them to speak well and write well, we need to find that balance somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's a thorny issue, too, because, you know, a lot of folks bring up online and digital education and endorse it or advocate for it for its cost, supposed cost-saving right. benefits. And the research actually suggests that that's not really the case. I mean, it's not really cheaper. An online education is not necessarily cheaper than a face-to-face one. Now, if you're talking about massive open online courses and you're just auditing content and you're not, you know, expecting credit for it and it's, you know, a sort of tangential thing to your education, an informal version of your education, that can be much cheaper. But you don't get the diploma right. out of it. I mean, that's starting to change now. But we're a long way from that being a viable path for most undergraduates. So, you know, the cost saving has to come, public policy has to change in order for cost saving to be effective. I mean, the problem, the reason why college is so much more expensive now is not because of, you know, what's actually happening on campus. It's what's happening in the state legislature.
Well, and that's a whole political discussion for another time, and one that I've had on a number of occasions already. So we were talking about what's next for Chris. He's, you know, the robes have been put away. The hat, or are they still out for you to admire and for?
I haven't packed the medal away yet. I got a medal. I didn't know I was going to get a medal. I mean, it wasn't special to me. Everybody who graduated with a PhD got it, but I didn't know that was part of the deal. So that was nice.
What you talked about, maybe, you know, going the traditional academic route, that's the probability of that is low. Mm-hmm. The alternative education academic route, it might be a little bit more realistic. What are the other options then that you have?
Yeah, well, so the alt-ac path is the one that I'm pursuing the most aggressively right now. And honestly, in the realm of these questions of digital and online education that we've been talking about, I mean, I think there's a lot to be done on campuses like CU Boulder and like so many campuses across the country to educate different constituencies on campus about what online and digital education really is, where it came from, what it's been doing, and what it might do in the future. Now, this can happen in a number of different capacities. So, you know, some colleges and universities have departments of continuing education where online education has been happening for a long time, and there's some advocacy that can be done there. A lot of campuses that don't already have online programs are starting to become very interested in them. And so, you know, deans and provosts and presidents need to be educated about these sorts of things so that they can make informed and strategic decisions about how to implement online and digital initiatives. So I think getting folks who are deep in the world of academic study, right? I mean, like who are at the master's and PhD level, getting those folks into positions, staff positions, administrative positions, where they can start to exert influence on shaping, you know, program and curricular development is something that needs to happen and isn't happening enough. You know, the classic divide for colleges and universities is between faculty and administrators, right? Like the faculty are frustrated by the administrators and the administrators are trying to control the faculty and everybody hates each other. And now we know that in practice it's not really that simple, but there is still a real sense that the priorities of faculty and the priorities of administrators are different. And I think the more common ground that can be made in eroding that perceived binary, the better off undergraduates and graduate students at most colleges and universities are going to be, right? Because they're going to get a better, more streamlined university infrastructure helping them facilitate their education. So I really, since learning and sort of participating by way of teaching online myself over the last few years, learning about this field and this the scope of these questions, I really feel there's a lot of work to be done. And so I'm trying to carve a path down that road.
Do you want to be in a classroom?
I would love to remain in the class. I love the classroom. And right now, for the last 3 years, I've been teaching exclusively in virtual classrooms, and I still love it.
Okay.
So I would love to have my foot still in a classroom.
So what does a virtual classroom look like? And I'll admit that, you know, I now follow you on Twitter, and I did that because I saw your CV, and so I was kind of interested, and just by going through your Twitter, it seemed to me that you were using your Twitter account as a way of engaging, I'm assuming, your students in talking about and bringing them in to think about ideas and whatever it was that they were reading. And I can't remember whatever.
So the last couple semesters I've been teaching a class classified as Topics in Popular Culture.
Okay.
And so for me, my version of that class is called Fandom in the Digital Age. So we look at very popular culture, like Kim Kardashian, Beyonce, Hunger Games, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And think about how people collect as a fandom around a particular pop cultural person or story or object, and then how that fandom is expressed and communicated through digital media. So for me in that class, I used Twitter as the platform for full class discussion. So my students are given a particular passage or image, you know, a few times a week. They do some close reading exercises on it and engage with each other on Twitter to talk about these digital media objects on digital media in order to sort of get a sense of how different communication networks work. So the reason why I chose Twitter was because, you know, the going discussion platform on most learning management systems is kind of a threaded discussion forum,
right?
Like something we're familiar with in online travels. And I found that technology to be useful, but not representative of the types of relationships I wanted my students to have when they were engaging with one another.
Why Twitter and not Reddit?
Well, specifically, the simple answer is that I don't know Reddit well.
Okay.
And I know Twitter reasonably well. Mm-hmm. And so on the surface of it, Twitter was sort of my go-to choice. And also, I think I wanted to avoid the thread concept. I wanted a more sort of flexible network kind of construction in terms of the engagement, where students weren't necessarily always responding to something. They were generating, you know, new things, and then sort of cross connections would happen based on how students were relating to each other. So I think Reddit could accomplish. I think Reddit makes an improvement on your sort of standard discussion forum, and in some ways it would overcome some of the limitations of that platform as it exists on most learning management systems. But Twitter for me seemed a natural connection between, you know, the way that pop culture happens right now and the way, and it was kind of reclaiming that technology from that platform from its worst manifestations, right? It was like teaching students that you can use Twitter for more than just like trolling people.
Do you see your dissertation as having a life beyond what it has now? I mean, is there a book in here? Is there a...
I certainly hope so.
Right.
I think there is. My advisor thinks there is, which is good. Right. So yes, I mean, I think practically speaking, to pursue a traditional academic career path, there has to be a life in this past where it is now. But I do think that if I can fill in some gaps conceptually and in the timeline of the dissertation, I think there really is a book-length argument in how higher education handles its own debts to cultural capital and the sort of representation of prestige, both in the content that it trades in and in how it educates students. So, yeah, I think there is value. There's book-length value in that, which may be, you know, an expression of hubris to say that. But I worked, you know, for a long time on this, and I think there's more to say on the topic. But my immediate goal for post-graduation dissertation work is trying to work on journal articles as opposed to, like, the full book right now. Because I think the ideas need to percolate for a while.
You've got you've put the... You've put the whiskey in the barrel. Now it just needs to age a little bit, right?
Well, that's historically how it worked, right? I mean, before the job market crisis where you had to have a book in order to get a job, you know, you would write your PhD dissertation, you'd get a teaching and research job at a university upon graduation, and then people would spend 10, 15 years really producing their next, like, major statement, major book-length statement. And that timeline is inconceivable now. You know, and so the benefit of it is that you would read that sort of first, that next book after the dissertation. You read them now and they're, you know, just meticulously well-crafted, beautiful, you know, instances of literary criticism, and they're tight and well-written, and, you know, I mean, they're great books. And we just, a candidate, even someone who gets a traditional academic job, doesn't have the luxury of waiting 10, 15 years to write the next book. Like, they're going to be up for tenure review in 4 or 5 years. They better have a book under their belt. Right. So it just, that kind of long-term meditative, contemplative kind of academic practice just isn't really, it's not really the model that we can use anymore. And so that's not to say that books that are pumped out fast aren't good, because a lot of academic monographs are produced very quickly after dissertation defenses, and they're great. But it's a different kind of flow. And I think for my particular project, you know, having the space of a little bit of extra time would benefit it.
Do you have some postdoc work planned or?
Yeah. So, you know, in the near term, I'm going to be doing some teaching for continuing education, who I work for now.
Right.
And doing some professional development work for online instructors and programs. And then after that, still working it out.
When do you need to get a real job?
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible.
If you're listening, reach out.
He's on Twitter. He's on LinkedIn, and I'll post his LinkedIn profile. If somebody needs a job, I got an admin job down at the office. Will that work? You live in Broomfield. You don't want to drive all the way to the DTC. Chris Haynes, thank you very much. Congratulations.
Thank you.
This mom and dad must have been super proud.
They came out to watch me walk across stage. Yeah, I think they were pretty proud.
What, real quick before we end here, what's it like? You said you have a long history in your family of academics. How many other PhDs are there in the back?
So not as many PhDs as there are, you know, other advanced degrees and other educators. I'm a third generation PhD. So my dad's dad had a PhD. He was a faculty in ophthalmology at Pacific University, and my dad is a PhD, and now I have a PhD.
Did you read your dad's dissertation?
I have not actually read my dad's. Man, that's kind of...
Has your dad read your dissertation?
I'm sure not. Because I'm sure mine's longer than his. He was a scientist. He is a scientist, so he's got that sort of tight, you know, research-driven focus on his work, and mine is 300 pages of argument. So,
does he still teaches and researches?
Close to retirement, but yes.
Well, that's neat.
Yes,
Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Again, congratulations and thank you to Dr. Christopher Haynes. You can catch him on the Twitter handle at _ChrisHaynes. If you got a job for a newly minted PhD in English Lit, you might want to track him down on the Twitter feed. I'll also have that Twitter handle on the information section of this podcast posting. Also, another shout out and a thank you to Andy up at Albums on the Hill. Go up to Boulder if you need a brand new set of tunes and go check out Andy Schneidkraut's wonderful shop, Albums on the Hill. Thank you for your time. As always, you can check out my bloviations at themountaingeek.net. That's the blog. Twitter is at themountaingeek. And have a great week. Next episode in 2 weeks or so, I'm going to be talking to a PhD in biology who also spends some time at science fiction conventions talking about the intersection of science and video games. Until then, keep shoveling.